Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears. Hello, and welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about professors, prisoners, and pregnant ladies. I am one of your hosts, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
Hey, Laura.
Hey, Elizabeth.
How's it going?
It's good. How are you?
I feel like we haven't talked in a while, probably because we haven't talked in a while.
Yeah, I was just thinking that we haven't recorded since Christmas, right?
I think it was like right after Thanksgiving. I was just very lazy when it came to doing the editing, so I didn't get it. I didn't get the last episode up, episode 19, until a couple weeks ago, like 2 weeks ago. So I hope you guys are enjoying our post-Thanksgiving, pre-Christmas banter in the middle of January. So you're welcome.
I know I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, but unlike pre-Christmas, post-Thanksgiving banter, I did not enjoy Christmas. How about you?
There were some good moments. There were some disappointing moments. Our Christmas Day plans got canceled because of COVID. But I did get to see my family on Christmas Eve. Big family get together. That was a lot of fun. I think probably the highlight was my niece, who's almost four. There was like a little charcuterie tray out, and she was just grabbing goat cheese by the fistfuls and shoving it in her mouth.
Okay, first of all, she's not going to grow out of that. I'm just letting you know, because I grab goat cheese by the fistful.
It's so good.
I also heard that you got to meet Uncle, or you got to see Uncle Federal Judge. What about Gin and Diet Coke cousin?
Oh yes, he was there. He was there with his girlfriend, who is Miss Georgia, and over like I think right before Thanksgiving or right before Christmas, she was in the Miss USA pageant. The one not owned by Trump.
Okay, so the real one, not the like knockoff, like creepy
version. Yeah.
Well, first of all, that sounds cool as hell. And
yeah, she's way out of his league, and we just don't understand how he pulled that.
Yeah, I was gonna ask without being rude.
Even his mother is like, yeah, I don't know.
I didn't want to be like, so is your cousin ugly? Or is he really hot and also rich? Apologies to Laura's cousin.
He's a good looking guy. He is Republican though. He is a Republican. Yeah, I know.
Well, speaking of Republicans, I got to spend almost an entire week with my immediate family. My sister came in from Oregon, so I decided to bite the bullet and go visit my parents with her for 5 whole fucking days. And
how did that go?
Oh, like you would expect. The first like day and a half, everyone had their like best behavior pleasant faces on, and then we drove an hour to Cabela's because there was nothing else to fucking do out in the middle of nowhere. It's this big outdoor store that has like hunting and fishing and stuff like that. Like Rachel, since she's moved to Oregon, has become an outdoors lady, and she has a hunting dog. So mm-hmm. We were like, well, we could either watch Star Trek again, which we watched plenty of, by the way. Not that I'm complaining. Uh-huh. So we drive an hour there and an hour back. And I can't drive with my parents because they're terrible drivers and they make me barf. So I always drive. Mm-hmm. But then my elderly parents are like, oh, Elizabeth, slow down. Elizabeth, you're getting too close. Elizabeth, my mom literally gasps and grabs the oh shit handle every time I break for any reason at all. This is not helping.
Yeah. So when I'm driving, Michelle has a tendency to press the imaginary brake that's on the the passenger side. Yeah.
Oh, my mom used to do that a lot. My mom refuses to sit in the front seat when I'm driving because she's afraid. I've been to law school and I'm a grown up, and you're still treating me like I'm 15. Though to be fair, I did, when I had to learn this permit, I did crash the car twice. So I feel like she's like working off of old information.
Oh gosh. With a learner's permit?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How much did your insurance go up after the second one?
Well, that's the funny story, is that my insurance was like, bye. They kicked me off my parents' insurance. There is precedent for thinking I'm a shitty driver, but
sure.
This is like 20-year-old precedent. And I, first of all, the last three accidents I was in, not my fault. I hear there's big news out of Georgia.
Oh my gosh. So last night, we're recording this Tuesday, January what? 11th. University of Georgia won the national championship in football against Alabama last night. I think the final score was 33-18. First time in 41 years that we've won a national championship. So well-deserved, overdue. So excited.
So I have a question. Didn't the Braves win the World Series, and that was long overdue too?
Yes. So for the first time in my entire life, it does not suck to be a sports fan in Georgia, because the Braves just won the World Series in November. Whoa, I was just caught in a glitch right there. I think it was early November.
No, that's really great. See,
yes,
I like to think it's because you and I became friends and started this podcast. Because if you think about it, ever since we started putting out this podcast, Georgia has gotten better at sports.
It's true, but the Falcons and the Hawks still kind of suck. So maybe next year.
You can't be greedy. you got two in 1 year.
I just have to say one thing. Do you know what I am totes obsessed with right now?
Birds?
No. In addition to birds.
What's that?
Taylor Swift's Red Taylor's version.
Ooh.
The album, mostly All Too Well 10-minute version. I cannot stop listening to that song. If you pull it up on Spotify, I have probably account for 10% of those listens. And like, you've got to watch the music video she did for it, because it's more like a short movie. It's like 15 minutes. There are very few people in this world that could re-release their own music and people would still pay for it again.
Would you like to discuss today's episode? It is season one, episode 20, exclamation point. This is a 20th episode.
Wow, that's insane.
And it's called Murder Takes the Bus.
Murder Takes the Bus. So we're starting out here in Cabot Cove, and Jessica is accompanying Sheriff Amos Tupper to the Sheriff's Association dinner, at which Jessica is also giving a speech. And Amos is super excited about this dinner, because at the end of the dinner, there's going to be a drawing for a big screen TV or a TV. I'm not sure if they had big screen back in 1984.
I mean, it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was a like, big-ass
like
TV.
24 inches. It's like one of those tube TVs.
But they have to take the bus because Amos's sheriff's car has broken down. Amos is at the bus stop getting the ticket, and then there's this couple that walks out of the little bus place where you buy your tickets. And this couple is like kind of cryptically arguing, and he's a total asshole. And he says something to the effect of, "This is between me and him. Don't get in my way." And he's just being a real dick to her. And she's pregnant. And
she's very pregnant.
Did you catch who the pregnant lady is?
Only by name, because I've never seen The Exorcist, but it is the one and only Linda Blair. Yes. Reprising her role as person who has to deal with a lot of shit.
Also known as Reagan.
Yes.
I honestly don't remember her name. I just called her Reagan. And then her dickhole husband, baby daddy, I think his name is Steve.
Yeah, I think so.
So this big bus pulls up, and the bus driver, who we later find out his name is Ben Gibbon, he's taken over that route for the normal bus driver who is out sick with the flu.
We also get this one instance of this guy I've nicknamed Red Bowtie, who's this old man who has no concept of personal space. And he's one of those people who, like, randomly starts conversations with you, like, on the subway when you clearly don't want to talk to him.
We are on the bus, and there's this weird-looking sea captain, and then there's this older couple, and the older couple is Major Frank Burns from MASH, and then there is Blanche from the Gold Girls. So they're a couple. And he is a college math professor, and she is the librarian at the college. So it's really stormy out, it's rainy, it's creepy, and then the bus has to make a stop right outside a prison. And you know it's a prison because there's like that barbed wire at the top of the fence that's really creepy.
There's also a sign that says state prison.
I was using context clues. They pick up this guy who's presumably just been let out of prison. And then they stop at this roadblock where the police tell them there's a flood up ahead, but they can go on through, but then the road will probably close soon. Shortly after they leave this roadblock, they come across a car that has run off the road. This car has actually been tailing them kind of like the whole trip, but at one point the car jumps in front of them, and then you can see he just, I don't know, hydroplanes into a tree. So the guy gets on the bus, and I think he's pretty handsome. He has a gun. He has, like, the holster, like, carrying it under his jacket. And he's pretty handsome, but he has this dumb look on his face all the time. Like, he just looks...
It's like Tony from episode 8. Like, very handsome, not very useful, kind of has, like, resting hot guy face.
Yes.
This is the first bottle episode that we have on this show.
Can you explain what a bottle episode is in case there's people out there like me who have never heard of
that term? You know what it is. You just maybe not have heard the term. And a bottle episode is an episode where the cast and the setting are limited, like a ship in a bottle. And in this one, there's not a lot of extras. There's not people coming and going. You're not getting a lot of scene changes. We'll get into it more, kind of see how it makes sense in this context, but we're introduced to the people on the bus by sight, and these people will become like our best friends for the next 45 minutes.
So at this point, everyone's on the bus, it's raining, it's stormy, it's really creepy, and then we come across this store called the Cozy Kitchen Corner, and they have to stop there because of engine trouble. So everyone's getting off the bus, and Reagan tells Steve to just let it be. And he, like, talks to her like a dog and says, go on, stay out of it. And then he stays behind on the bus. So everyone else is getting into the restaurant. They're ordering tea and coffee. And there's, like, one guy in the restaurant who's working. He's the owner. He says something about a bridge being washed out. And then at this point, Amos is really fretting about missing the fruit cup and the potato soup at the sheriff's dinner.
He's got that menu down. He's committed it to memory, and he's got it timed out perfectly, which is something that I cannot help but admire in its precision. I don't think I've ever been that dedicated to a meal.
I have. That was the disappointing Christmas cancellation. We were supposed to go to the St. Regis Hotel for Christmas brunch. And what's good about this is that it's not, they had the traditional Christmas food, but then they also have seafood. So the year that I went, I racked up on crab claws, lobster tail, shrimp, sushi. A few minutes later, Jessica and Amos finish eating their pie, and Amos goes to call Portland to tell them that they're going to be late. And then the bus driver comes in from working on the engine to dry off, but he tells everyone they're not going to be leaving soon. So then Jessica goes back on the bus to grab a book, and she discovers the dead body of the guy who got on at the prison stop, and there's a screwdriver in his neck.
After this discovery, we go back to the Cozy Corner Kitchen, which I've nicknamed the KKK, which is what it is. Jess is trying to coax Amos into taking charge of the situation, and Amos stands up on Jessica's prodding and says, oh, I know I don't have any jurisdiction here, but here's what we should do. And this is something that we are going to talk about in the next segment, is the issue of jurisdiction, which is actually something that's quite interesting, and that, spoiler alert, this episode got wrong. And Jessica tells Amos that she could tell that this guy just got out of prison because of his new suit and his new dollar bills. He was carrying a book when he got on the bus, and they're looking through his pockets. They find an expired driver's license and this mysterious photo of like four people. His suitcase is missing. They kind of zero in on his neck and they see what look like bruises, and potentially I thought they were powder burns, but I think I was wrong. I think it ended up being grease.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of blood, so that's something to kind of tuck away. So Blanche from the Golden Girls ambles onto the bus, and she had previously like geeked out to Jessica and told her how great it was, and as a librarian she understands what it's like. Well, which is really interesting because the character of Blanche in The Golden Girls is, I know that you haven't seen it, for lack of a better term, she's supposed to be the slut.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she's the gaudy, brazen one. Uh-huh. She's the one who goes out and throws herself at men. And this is also, like, on the heels of something we didn't mention, mm-hmm. that we lost the great, great Betty White on New Year's Eve because God hates us.
What is it that you say? Not R.I.P. What do you say?
R.S.V.P.
R.S.V.P. Oh.
Betty White.
Betty White.
And then, you know, in that same vein, didn't Bob Saget, that was it yesterday?
Oh, yeah, either yesterday or the day before.
I have mixed feelings about Bob Saget, but I think everybody was just absolutely crushed by the Betty White thing, even though she was 99 years old.
She's a goddamn treasure.
They put out that People magazine where she was talking about turning 100, and then she, like, dies. That was it. That's what killed her. Stupid People magazine. Blanche, in this case, is, like, trying to be a mousy librarian, but the actress, Rue McClanahan, I think that's how you say it, she can't really turn it off.
No.
So even when she's trying to be, like, this mousy, you know, she's got big glasses, she's wearing, like, a pussy bow blouse, she's still Blanche.
Yeah.
Blanche ambles onto the bus, she freaks out, and they kind of have to bundle her back into the KKK, where Bowtie says that all the phones are dead, and they're stuck there by themselves. The payphone is out. I think there's maybe 10 of them together. We have Bowtie, we have the sea captain, we have the librarian and her husband, we have Amos and Jess, that's 6, and then we have Ralph, the restaurant owner. We have stupid, dumb, pretty guy, and then we have
the couple, Reagan and Reagan's husband. It's 10. Yes. Nice guesstimating.
I know. I'm really good at eyeballing things. That's why I'm such a good parallel Parker. They're all kind of sitting there and they're eyeballing each other. And Blanche decides to be calm and freak out and accuse Ralph of trying to poison her with the coffee. They kind of start talking amongst themselves, and Jessica remembers the guy's name. The guy's name is Gilbert Stoner, the dead guy. And she remembers from 15 years ago, a bank robbery in Boston, the Danvers Trust bank robbery. And in this bank robbery, there were two partners involved, and one of them was killed during the attempt. A bystander was killed, and then we find out there is a missing partner. And this Gilbert Stoner guy, he was the only one who went down for it because he's the only one they could catch. Jess, in the meantime, is kind of feeding Amos information and prodding him along. And she starts asking people where they were. And I called him Professor Kent, because his name was Kent. He said he was playing video games. He's playing Roadhog. There's like a gift shop or something or whatever. He was playing this video game, kind of like the one Ethan played. I think it might have been the same one, to be honest with you, because it was a driving game. I might go back and check that, because it was called Roadhog.
Yeah, we should check that.
So he was playing Roadhog in wherever Roadhog was. Bowtie apparently heard him. We find out Bowtie is a retired postal worker. Steve is a computer programmer. And then Jess full on calls out dumb, handsome guy, asks him what the fuck he's doing with a gun. He says that he's a jewelry salesman and he has to carry all this jewelry. The bus guy comes back in. Mr. Gibbons comes back in. He says, I'm still working on the bus. No change. So that kind of sucks. And they all start just kind of pointing fingers at one another. it's like this really funny parlor game because we had called it, you had called it, kind of equated it to Clue, but like a weird version of Clue.
Yeah, it's like Clue meets Murder at the Orient Express.
Steve's dad was one of Mr. Stoner's accomplices, and that he was killed during the robbery. There's a third guy missing. That's kind of where things are. Jess, again, still investigating, leading Amos around. They go back to the bus, and Amos, in a rare moment of usefulness, notices that the damper switch and the bus is on. I don't know what that means, but the takeaway from that is that the bus isn't actually broken. The bus driver just faked it for some reason. And Jess, meanwhile, kind of skulks around outside. It's still pouring. And there was this one funny moment where she, like, bursts into the kitchen thinking there's going to be some big reveal. And it's just Ralph making sandwiches.
That was so funny.
Kitty kind of was like, oh, hey. And it's like the yeah, summer camp sandwiches, like the bologna with, like, the piece of, oh, God.
And the cheese that you get out of the, like, cellophane wrap or whatever. He didn't even think anything was weird or suspicious that, like, this old lady is just opening the kitchen door. He's just like, oh, well, hello there.
So while Jessica is skulking, she stumbles upon the missing suitcase. It's been rifled through. And while she's looking through this suitcase in the rain, she's being skulked upon by a second skulker. And then all of a sudden, cut to commercial.
So we come back from commercial, and the second skulker is Steve, and he's kind of got, like, a scary look on his face. Like, they make it look like he, like, might harm Jessica for a minute or a second. And he explains to Jessica that he didn't kill Stoner, and then Jessica asks him to help bring in the suitcase from the rain. Jessica is going through the suitcase in some kind of back room with Sheriff Tupper, Steve, and Reagan. And the clothing has been ripped apart, and still missing is Stoner's overcoat and the book that he brought with him onto the bus. These items are not in the suitcase. Those things are still missing. And Jessica asks Steve to tell them what he and Stoner, the dead guy, were arguing about earlier on the bus. So, as Elizabeth already explained, Steve's dad was one of the robbers in the robbery 15 years ago. He was the one that was killed, and Steve was in junior high when this happened. And Steve knew that Stoner was getting out of prison and wanted to confront Stoner about getting his dad's cut of the money. But then after talking to Stoner, Steve changed his mind because Steve said that Stoner was just a mean, miserable man. And he didn't want the robbery ruining his life. Then Steve explained how he knew of Stoner's release from a newspaper clipping. And Amos reads the article out loud. And then it mentions that the innocent bystander that was killed, and her name was Julie Gibbons, which is the last name of the bus driver. His name is Ben Gibbons. So then Amos says, well, that seals the deal. I knew who the killer was 30 minutes ago. So back in the main room of the restaurant, Amos says he's making a citizen's arrest of Ben Gibbons. And he starts talking about the emergency damper switch, which is only to be used when the engine runs away. I don't know what that means. Sounds serious.
Just from context, and, you know, all you bus experts out there can tell us, it's like a kill switch, an emergency brake, but you have to, like, go back and manually reset it after you've pulled it. I feel like that might be what it is. Or it could be nothing, or it could be something that just exploded. I don't know.
But once this emergency damper switch is thrown, it can only be reset by hand, which is located in the engine compartment. And it's, like, way back in the back, and you have to use a tool like a long screwdriver. So the bus driver then admits that the girl that was killed in the robbery was his daughter, and then he just starts to confess. So he says that he heard Stoner was going to be let out of prison, so he traded routes with the regular driver. And then he staged the bus breakdown, and he was, like, pretending to work on the damper switch until Stoner was alone. And when everyone left the bus but Stoner, the bus driver went back on the bus, and Stoner was sleeping like a baby. And the bus driver just killed him in a fit of rage.
Do you know where we've seen the bus driver before? Because this is something actually that I forgot no. to mention. I don't actually know the actor's name, but he was the dad in My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Oh, I didn't
the
see
Windex
that
The Windex guy. Google it.
I didn't see that movie.
What good are you then?
I know. Jessica then pipes up and says, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Actually, Stoner wasn't killed by the screwdriver. He wasn't sleeping when the bus driver stabbed him because he was already dead. And Jessica points to the evidence that there was little to no blood on the screwdriver or the wound. And that was because post-mortem lividity, so the blood was beginning to settle in the lower parts of Stoner's body, meaning he was killed 15 to 20 minutes earlier. Also, Jessica surmises that he died of strangulation and not stabbing.
And then there was also grease on his
collar. Yeah, so there was like, the grease stains on his collar. Yeah. Amos tries to go see if a payphone's working. It's not working. And then the restaurant owner, 45 minutes after I would imagine that everyone's gotten there, he remembers that he has a CB radio in the back, but he doesn't know how to use it. But he and the handsome gun guy go to the back to try to use it. But Jessica notices that handsome gun guy leaves his briefcase on the table. And supposedly this briefcase is supposed to have a lot of expensive sample jewelry in it. So Jessica goes back there to confront him about it. And he confesses that he's actually an investigator for the insurance company from the Danvers Trust robbery. And he's been assigned to follow Stoner to see if Stoner goes to the money.
So this is another case where I feel like Jess was awfully bold in accusing the man with the gun of, malfeasance. So I guess props to her.
But I think that she really read his face and just saw the dumb look and was like, I'm not threatened by this guy.
Yeah, that's fair. He probably doesn't even know how to use the gun.
Meanwhile, Jess and Amos are back in the main room whispering in the corner. There's a question, maybe the killer was likely Stoner's partner, but who is it? Jessica's still stuck on the suitcase. The book and the overcoat weren't in there. So where's the book and the overcoat? Then Jessica has an idea to go back on the bus. And then this is where it hits me that Stoner kind of looks like a more handsome Steve Buscemi.
That was not in my notes. Steve Buscemi is his own kind of attractive because he owns his ugliness. So I feel like he's kind of his own thing.
He is not a cute man.
No, he's not. That. But he's not like a not cute man that knows he's not cute and is really defensive about it. He's just like, fuck yeah, I'm ugly. The fuck you gonna do?
My mom got one of those aura frames a few months ago. So everyone, all the kids can upload photos to her frame.
Steve Buscemi photos.
I've been thinking about putting in pictures of Steve Buscemi in the frame.
Don't do it. Photoshop his eyes onto a family picture. That way it's way more subtle.
My mom would never notice that though. No, she would never notice
but
that.
But you would know and you would giggle every time that you uploaded a new family photo. And eventually you can try to take over all the family photos and have everybody with Steve Buscemi eyes.
I don't even know how to Photoshop. Jessica is back on the bus and she notices that Stoner is not sitting in the same seat as when he first got on the bus. He was originally sitting in the seat behind where he is now. So she goes and looks and she finds the overcoat and the book. Do you remember what the book is called?
It's called The Hangman Something.
The Night the Hangman Sang. When I first saw the title, I thought it might have been one of Jessica's. Back at the KKK, and Jessica is flipping through the book, and we notice that it's the first edition, but the jacket is all ripped, but the pages are new, and they haven't been cut, so it's obvious no one has actually read the book. And then there's a big bang of thunder and a flash of lightning, and the lights go out, and Amos goes back with Ralph to help with a generator, and while they're figuring out the generator, this dark figure runs into the back room and you hear a gunshot. And then it turns out that handsome gun guy was shot in the arm and the CB radio is all smashed up and the gun is gone. The person, the dark figure, took the gun.
I don't know if it's stupid pretty guy or Jessica who says it's only a flesh wound.
I thought of a merely flesh wound. Yes. Come back up, bite your ankles off.
There's a missing gun running around and pretty stupid guy has been defanged. Everybody's ratcheting the anxiety up to 11. The one person missing from the scene right now appears to be the bus guy who is ostensibly still out fixing the bus. Everyone else is accounted for. They're all kind of like sitting around again, like looking at each other shiftily. Blanche is, in the meantime, she's knitting, and I didn't actually look close enough to see if she was doing it correctly, but I'm willing to bet she didn't. Because, just side note, Elizabeth's knitting corner is when you see people in books. You see people on TV and movies that have like the two needles, and they're kind of like clicking against each other, and there's one in each hand. It's not really how it works. Because normally you hold one idle while the other one has the working needle. Okay, thank you for allowing me that digression.
Explaining how knitting works is top podcast quality.
Well, we all don't have cousins who are dating Miss Georgia, so some of us have to be interesting. And we don't have exciting lives watching birds and listening to Taylor Swift. We have our sea captain. We have a retired postal worker who speaks like an old-timey radio show. And then we have the professor and the librarian and the Steve the programmer and his pregnant wife. And I was thinking about it being like when you order the Village People off of Wish and instead you get like this weird cast of characters. And everybody's really leaning into their shtick. Like, the professor's wearing tweed, the sea captain's got the beard, he looks like a personification of the old sea captain from The Simpsons. We find out that Blanche has stolen the book because it was a rare first edition, and Jess accuses her, pulls it out of her knitting bag, and then they crack the spine, and it turns out there's a key to a safety deposit box in there. There's more finger pointing, more shifty eyes, and Jess points to Sea Captain, who's Captain Downing, and outs him as the third accomplice. And the reason why she figured that out is because when he was bandaging some pretty man's wound, he like tied a different knot than a sailor would tie, which I know I'm the resident boat expert here, but I feel like that's not dispositive. He spills the beans. He says, oh, I wanted to follow him and get my money, but he didn't kill him. So this has turned into murder on the Orient Express. Literally everybody on this bus, I think, except for the postal worker, we never figure him out, is gunning for Ratchet, aka Gilbert Stoner. All of a sudden, Jess accuses the bus driver, and she says Amos was right, which is not something we hear very often. So it turns out that not only did the bus driver stab Stoner, he strangled him first, and then came back later and stabbed him. Jessica figures out it was him, like, based on the grease and because he was the only one that wasn't sitting around in the KKK. Like, he was outside unsupervised the whole time, almost. He confesses, spills the beans. I said he confronted Stoner on the bus, and then he saw the sea captain, and he had to hastily cover it up, and then he had to come back and stab him. He confesses, bus driver confesses. The next scene, the sun is out, and I think Jess is talking to, Bowtie Guy? She makes a comment about how a bus driver needs to get a lawyer. He has a good chance at a temporary insanity defense.
I think the best part of the entire episode is that Jessica was the one who won the TV from the drawing at the Sheriff's Association. But because she wasn't there, she doesn't get the TV.
Womp womp.
Womp womp.
Well, that is our episode.
So let's start unpacking this.
That's an interesting metaphor because they're traveling and there was a suitcase.
Let's start with kind of the most obvious thing, which I think was the most obvious. So the bus driver, he confesses to killing a dead guy, essentially. Is that a crime? Obviously, it's not murder. So let's assume that the bus driver did not strangle Stoner originally, but did stab him. But he did stab a dead guy with a screwdriver with the intent on killing him. Is that a crime?
I want to say yes. An attempt of a crime, certain crimes, is itself a crime. They intend to do it? Yes. Was there a substantial step taken? Yes, he stabbed the guy. Does the fact that the guy is already dead, does that change anything?
Yes, I think so. In law, you've got mens rea, which is the guilty mind, and then actus reus. I think it's actus reus, which is the guilty act. He definitely had mens rea. He definitely had the intent to kill the guy, but he did not have the actus reus when the bus driver stabbed him because he was already dead. So he could not have carried that out.
A lot of times you'll get the guilty act with either a less guilty mind or something like second degree murder or whatever. I feel like very rarely do you get the evil mind, like you got that down pat, but you can't fulfill the actus reus because it's impossible. And that's actually called the impossibility defense. Like, you can't kill somebody who's already dead. It's legally and factually not possible. You might be able to get them on a weapons thing if they use a gun.
Probably some kind of like corpse desecration, which I think is just a misdemeanor.
Yeah. He didn't do anything, assuming that he hadn't killed him the first time. He didn't do anything to not commit the crime. As far as he was concerned, the crime was complete. He intended and he did the thing. It was just by circumstance that the guy happened to be dead. So
you're thinking, like, should this guy serve some time because he wanted to kill the guy? He took every action he could possibly take to kill the guy. It just turns out by his own dumb luck, he couldn't actually kill the guy.
The Wikipedia article I read kind of approximated another example of the impossibility defense is if you're shooting into like a room where you think a person is but isn't there. And that's not attempted murder because you're just shooting the wall. But in your mind, you were shooting your friend Joe who double-crossed you. So I feel like err on the side of not prosecuting people for their thoughts, because once you go down that slope, there's not really any turning back.
This brings up two things. Have you seen Minority Report with Tom Cruise?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I've seen it a long time ago, but that's what they were essentially doing, is they, some kind of like government agency would somehow find out when someone was thinking about murdering someone.
It's the psychic people in the pool. Like, they were able to predict the future and then translate the future into like a billiard ball with somebody's name on it.
Also reminds me of the Law and Order SVU episode that was, it was about child pornography, but the child pornography was actually an adult person. And they did the image to make it look like a child. So that's kind of the gray area, because it's not a child. They are not looking at pornography of a child. They are looking at an actual adult that has been like CGI'd to look like a child.
I feel like I also heard about this in the context of illustrations. There was some debate as to whether to like classify your teenage anime porn as child porn, because you know these are teenagers that you're drawing. But I'm not sure kind of where that went, but as far as I remember, like, they came down on the side of it's not a minor, because I mean, Josh Duggar aside, I would rather somebody look at pictures of a cartoon than a real person. But, you know, that in a perfect world, and yuck. I feel like that's a situation where there's no law to fit the crime. And
agreed. Maybe the law just hasn't caught up with technology.
One thing that kind of stuck out to me is the repeated claims of Sheriff Tupper and other individuals in this episode that the sheriff had no jurisdiction. Like, he wasn't permitted to make an arrest. He couldn't force anybody to answer questions. First of all, nobody can force you to answer questions. That's what the Fifth Amendment is for, if it's going to incriminate.
Right. Again, and this is not legal advice. No. If a cop or whoever asks you questions that you don't want to answer, you don't have to answer. You can just say, I'm not answering questions right now.
Yeah, and you have a right to counsel, whether you've been charged or anything. If a cop's getting aggressive or they're asking you questions you don't want to answer, they a lot of times will say, well, you know, if you're not, you have nothing to hide. And the thing of it is that's bullshit. Because even if you're not hiding a crime, you still have a right to privacy. So remember that. Ask for your attorney. I'm not answering questions.
Am I free to leave?
Yes. And the second they say you're not, we generally advise consulting an attorney, counsel.
Again, this is not legal advice, but...
this is just practical life advice, is if I were your friend, and hopefully I am your friend, strange listener.
After 20 episodes, we better be your fucking friend.
First of all, it's unclear what they mean by jurisdiction, because... in the case of the citizen's arrest, first of all, that's a whole other, like, bag of dicks that I not necessarily want to deal with right now. But in least according to Georgia and Maryland law, as of an hour ago, it is permissible for law enforcement officers operating out of their home jurisdictions to perform police functions and duties in certain circumstances. And those are situations like if you're working with a neighboring jurisdiction to solve a crime. But there's the big one is in an emergency. It seems like kind of a catch-all. And I feel like this would be an appropriate situation because if someone's been murdered, they're stranded, and everybody's looking at each other shiftily. I'm not a criminal attorney, and I would hazard a guess as that this might fall into the emergency category. And I think we'd also talked about the difference between a sheriff and a police officer. And I think in this case, at least, Amos is kind of the catch-all for, like, local lawman, because it's kind of unclear what his duties are.
Yeah, so, like, in Georgia, typically a sheriff has more civil responsibilities. Like, a sheriff will execute arrest warrants. A sheriff will serve someone with papers, like they're being served with a lawsuit, feeding tickets and stuff. And in Georgia, if you are post-certified, and I think that stands for public officer safety training. So if you are post-certified in Georgia, you essentially have arrest powers all over Georgia. So it doesn't matter if you are a sheriff in County A, you can still arrest someone in County Z. Now, as far as writing speeding tickets or ordinance tickets, that may not be applicable, but your arrest powers, I believe, extend throughout the state.
And in terms of the public, you said public officer, what was the
safety training post?
Would that like apply to situations like firefighters or...
No, firefighters are not post-certified. So post-certified means you actually have, like, the arrest powers.
Just because you can doesn't mean that you should. And that's where you get jurisdictional pissing contests and, you know, one sheriff and another arguing over.
So when I was doing civil litigation, there was an area that was, like, right at the county line of DeKalb County and Fulton County. And getting the sheriff's office to serve papers to a defendant there was impossible. Each time, like, I would send it to DeKalb County, and DeKalb County would say, oh, no, that's in Fulton County. So then I would send it to Fulton County, and Fulton County would say, oh, no, that's DeKalb County.
Was that, like, the DMZ, like, a lawless wasteland?
I would honestly not be surprised.
Where it's, like, Deliverance, as you've hearkened to a few times.
No, it wasn't Deliverance. It's not Deliverance type people, because we're in Atlanta here, but it's a...
You're talking about, like, more like The Wire?
Yeah.
Cool. You got that reference. Good job. You're almost ready to visit Baltimore. I'm only here for another, like, 2 months and change, so you better get on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do need to get on that.
I know. Or I guess, you know, say fuck Baltimore and just come to Portland.
Well, I'm definitely coming to Portland, too.
Goddamn right you are. I am going to learn how to surf again. I am so excited about
that. I didn't know that people surfed in Oregon.
Yeah, there's, like, a really kick-ass, like, surf spot, like, an hour and a half outside of Portland.
Is it cold? I bet it's cold.
So it's what wetsuits are for. Like, you don't go there to go swimming. You just buy a wetsuit, and then you go out there, and you can do it all year.
Does a wetsuit keep you not cold?
It's insulated, yeah.
So you don't feel cold?
Well, you're not supposed to, if it's doing its job. I mean, you might feel cold, but you're not going to freeze to death. The very last thing that is... It will give it the 3 seconds that the episode also gave it, was the idea of using temporary insanity as a defense, because
right,
an insanity defense, the statistics on it are, like, if you watch Law and Order and that's your only point of reference, you would think that every single case has an insanity defense, but it's something like less than like 2% or something. And then temporary insanity is an even smaller subset of that. And the premise behind it is the person lost touch with reason, couldn't control themselves, and just snapped. But in this context, the simple fact that he planned it?
Exactly. Like, there's so much evidence to negate a temporary insanity defense.
Even if he argued that he didn't intend to kill him, he went through hoops to get on the same bus with him. Like, he probably meant to do him some kind of harm.
There was this famous case from DeKalb County several years ago. I don't know if the name Hemi Newman or, God, I forget the other lady's name. But basically, this woman was having an affair, and the guy she was having an affair with killed the woman's husband. And he actually did win an insanity defense. Now, I don't think it was a temporary insanity, but basically I think he has to live his sentence in an institution rather than a prison.
That's another thing, is she made it sound like a get out of jail free card, or at least something that might be mitigating. But I don't know if it's civil commitment or whatever, but that can be even a little bit more nebulous than, like, having a prison term of set time, because you could be in there till someone declares you sane or fit to be with society. That might be a year, that might be 30 years. So don't do that. Practical advice, not legal advice.
So, Elizabeth, who was your Golden Grady?
My Golden Grady was Sea Captain.
Okay.
For the simple reason that he disguised, and I'm holding up air quotes, himself in a way that I would imagine Grady would try to blend in somewhere. And that's putting on a friggin' pea coat and talking like a pirate and saying a bunch of boat words. Like, that's ridiculous. And that is 1000% what Grady would do. I feel like that's the level of thought that was put into this. And it's not like you're in Kansas where there's not a lot of boats around. Like, literally fucking everybody in Maine knows somebody with a boat.
That's true. If you would have pretended to be like a wheat farmer, you might have gotten away with it.
But what's a wheat farmer doing in Maine?
Visiting family before he goes back to the farm.
Yeah. Ooh, good one. Yeah. But it's like a cousin or something, so not anybody too close.
So I'm giving the Golden Grady to Ralph, the owner of the KKK. And simply because it seems like Ralph just kind of fell into owning this thing. He's just there. He volunteers way too much information. He's just kind of like the guy in the background that says something stupid, which is exactly what Grady is. And then also, like, the whole, like, oh yeah, I have a CB radio. This could get us out of this whole, you know, debacle.
And I feel like he would be the type of person where he would not state something obvious. And then when somebody asked him why he didn't state the obvious, he'd be like, well, you never asked.
Exactly.
Yeah. And plus, but he does it with such a kind of a cheerfulness, almost. Like, the sandwich thing stuck out to me.
That was really cute.
I salute your choice. Solid respect.
So did you like the episode?
I like parts of it. I tend to not like bottle episodes in general. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there were just too many moving parts in this. Like, if it was going to be a bottle episode, it needed to be a little simpler. But if it was going to be, like, a full-on episode, it needed to be bigger. They didn't hit the right balance. There were too many people. And then I kept getting distracted by the bow tie guy because he was, like, speaking in riddles. So I was like, oh, he's speaking in riddles. I'm going to attach importance to this. And it turns out he's literally just a red bow tie herring.
He's, yeah.
So, like, I'm going to give it, like, 6.5 ashtrays. Again, we'll go back to the sandwich scene until I die. Like, that in itself deserves a solid star. What about you?
So I actually loved this episode. It had twists and turns. It was crazy. Who done it? Also, the cast was incredible. We had Reagan from The Exorcist. We had Blanche from Golden Girls. We had Frank from MASH. We had some guy from that Greek movie. My favorite board game is Clue. I recently saw the movie. Really enjoyed the movie.
Was that the one with Tim
Curry? Yeah.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah. It was really good. So it was a combination of Clue and Murder on the Orient Express. Phenomenal. I really enjoyed it. I give it 8 ashtrays.
Wow. You are generous. When the one with Kenneth Branagh came out a couple years ago, the Murder on the Orient Express, we went to see it in the theater. And, like, everyone knows the story. And we watched it. And he was, like, a neutral family movie. My mom started complaining on the way home about there being murder in it. And she didn't see why that was necessary. I'm like, it is in the fucking title of the movie. Murder, it's not called Forgiveness on the Orient Express.
That's like James Bond and Casino Royales. Well, I don't understand why they had to be in a casino. Why'd they have to gamble?
That sounds like something that my mom would say.
No, your mom should not watch any more movies. Unless Kirk Cameron's in them.
You can't see this, but I just made the world's ugliest face at Kirk Cameron for no other reason except he is terrible. Let us briefly talk about, hopefully, what is 2 weeks from now's episode and not, like, 2 months from now. This one is season 1, episode 21. So we're getting towards the end of season 1. Almost in time. I think we can squeeze it in before our 1 year anniversary. Because we started, I think, in March. March or April.
Okay.
So hopefully, you know, we're going to be doing this until, like, we're both old in nursing homes and stuff.
I mean, let's see, at this rate, so there's like 265 episodes. Yeah, so 12 years. Let's just take it episode by episode.
This is season 1, episode 21, Armed Response. While in the hospital with a fractured leg, Jessica investigates the murder of a doctor. Oh. I vaguely remember this one. I remember her being laid up and I think it was like her leg was broken and they kept telling her to, yeah, she's solving a mystery from her convalescence.
Oh, wait, is Jessica's legs broken? Oh.
She's not in the field. I don't think this is a Cabot Cove episode, so it looks like she probably has somebody else out collecting clues and she just has to put them together.
Oh, okay. I don't remember this one at all.
Have you ever seen The Bone Collector?
Yes, with Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie.
Yes, I saw the first 10 minutes of that and I assume they're about the same because the guy's stuck in a bed and he has to solve the crime based on other people's information. Anyway, that is what is on tap for us next time we decide to make a podcast. So always remember, don't answer questions. Eat your vegetables. We love you. Stay woke.
Stay woke.